Welcome back. I am Malihera Zozon, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past century, petroleum-based hydrocarbons have formed 90% of the synthetic materials that go into everything from computers to cosmetics, canned foods to baby shampoos. In her newest book, Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry, Elizabeth Grossman says these materials were designed to make life easier, more efficient, more convenient, and in many cases safer, and many do. But many of these substances also behave in ways that make them hazardous to human health and the environment, and in some instances altering the most fundamental building blocks of life on Earth. Since the birth of the modern chemistry, scientists have synthesized more than 82,000 chemicals. John Warner, a pioneer in green chemistry, figures that only about 10% of the chemicals on the market are truly safe, and the rest should be replaced by benign alternatives. So how toxic are these artificial chemicals, and how does green chemistry help make our products and the environment green and sustainable? To get some answers to these questions, we are joined by Elizabeth Grossman. She's an investigative journalist whose writing has appeared in Mother Jones, The Nation, Salon, and other publications. And she joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Good to have you, Lizzie.
Thanks for having me.
What an intriguing and interesting book. Scary, but very, very hopeful, I have to say.
Oh, good.
So our listeners should finish your book. So let's sort of get an overview of what you're exploring in your book. Artificial synthetic chemicals can be found in thousands of products that we use daily, and many of them, as you say, are harmful to health and the environment. And in your book, Chasing Molecules, you say that everything on Earth is made of chemicals, and toxins are naturally occurring phenomena, from mercury, poisonous plants, even water can become toxic to humans. So what concerns you the most when you talk about synthetically developed chemicals, and how big of a problem are we facing?
Well, I think what I might do is just back up a little bit in the story and tell you how I got interested in this, and then I think that will make my answer make some sense and give it a storyline. The book that I wrote before Chasing Molecules was called High Tech Trash, and in it I looked at the environmental and health impacts of the entire life cycle of high-tech electronics, from raw materials to manufacturing to what happens when we use them and then also dispose of them. And it was while working on that that I discovered that lots and lots of synthetic chemicals, and by that I mean chemicals that don't exist in nature, and they wouldn't exist at all if they hadn't been made in a laboratory, that just lots and lots of synthetic chemicals were and are turning up all over the world, in water, in soil, in air, in plants, in animals, and in people. And lots of these chemicals are turning up far, far away from where the products that they started in were ever made or used or even disposed of. And so I got really, really curious to know how it was that the kind of chemicals that are used, say, to make nonstick frying pans, give them their nonstick surfaces, which is a similar chemical that makes my rain jacket water repellent, which is a similar chemical to one that's been used in making semiconductor microchips for computer equipment. How is that chemical turning up in polar bears? How is that same chemical turning up in the blood of lots and lots of Americans, including newborn babies? So I set out to find out how and why this kind of thing was happening, and then how we could go about solving the problem.
And some of these chemicals stay in nature and in the environment for a long, long time. For example, you speak about some chemicals that were banned over 40 years ago, 50 years ago, like DDT in the United States that was banned in 1972. But in the Arctic Circle, where you went actually along with some scientists, they have found some native penguins continue to be exposed to the same level. How do these chemicals end up in Arctic, and why do these turtles and fish and sea mammals, they continue to be exposed to these chemicals that were banned 40 years ago.
Right. Well, there are a lot of the chemicals that have been developed over the past essentially century now, there have been quite a lot of them that are what scientists call persistent. They last a really long time in the environment because they resist natural breakdown, natural degradation, in part because a lot of them are not very water soluble, so they're not going to fall apart in our very watery environment. And some of them can get into water systems, they last in water systems, and then when there's evaporation and clouds form, they will move with precipitation. And because of the way air patterns and water patterns move around the globe, a lot of chemicals, if they're persistent enough and they're released in the northern hemisphere, they will eventually make their way north, and a lot of them have ended up in the Arctic. The penguins are actually down on the other side of the world in the Antarctic, and it's turned out to be sort of a problem for some things, but not that many people are doing that similar research there as many as they are in the Arctic. Yeah,
because you visited several places in the world.
Yeah, I actually went, that's sort of how the book got its name, because I realized that while working on the book, I spent a lot of time following scientists around who were looking at these compounds, these chemicals, on their global travels.
And you, I heard that you have a funny story, actually, in the way you, the reason you chose this title for your book. You had some other titles for the book.
I actually had a bunch of titles for this book, and that will also probably help sort of tell a little bit more about what I set out to look at here. And one of the things that I wanted to know about these chemicals is how and why we had come to use them, and how it was that we ended up with so many materials, things that do make stretchy waterproof surfaces and make lightweight shatterproof plastics, things that we've really come to depend on, things that make materials resist fire really efficiently. You know, how was it that we ended up with all of these really, really useful materials, so many of which also have really adverse environmental and health impacts? So I looked at the history of a lot of these synthetic chemicals, and one of the things that really struck me when I learned about that you mentioned in your introduction is that a lot of these materials started to be developed in the sort of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, after the big boom of oil development came into existence, and there were all of this excess petroleum around, and it turns out those molecules are really, really useful for making all sorts of things. And it seemed to me that back in sort of the 1920s, 30s, 40s again, and then on to the 50s and 60s, with all of these new synthetic materials, we kind of redesigned the future. And for a while, I was thinking I would call the book Redesigning the Future, because it seemed to me if we were going to solve this problem, we were going to have to start rethinking our materials all over again and thinking about a more sustainable, less resource-intensive basis and more environmentally benign set of materials to use. But everybody told me that if you put future in the title of your book, people would think it was science fiction. And if you're writing a science book, you don't want to be thought of as science fiction.
And well, some parts of your book really does sound like science fiction.
Well, I didn't make it up. And as a science journalist these days, you want to be really, really careful because people think you're making it up anyway.
You cannot believe the impact these chemicals have on our body and on the environment.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that was just really, really made a huge impression on me, because one of the things we've learned in the past 10 to 20 years is that not only do we have tens of thousands of chemicals that we're using in all sorts of products that we don't really understand their full environmental health effects, but one of the other things we've learned, in addition to the fact that things that we thought would stay in one place and would stay in finished products, we've learned that they're not staying in one place, and they're actually migrating out of things and getting into the air and then into water and into soil and into our bodies. And at the same time, we've also learned a huge amount about what those chemicals do once they get into living cells. And that's where the stuff starts to be almost incredible, because really tiny amounts of some of these chemicals can have such a profound effect on cells that they can affect more than one generation with a single exposure.
And that's the voice of Elizabeth Grossman, the author of Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Product, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry. Elizabeth's writing has appeared in Mother Jones, The Nation, Salon, and other publications. And if you would like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also drop us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Elizabeth, of the synthetic chemicals we are using now, about 90% are petrochemicals. So why don't we just get rid of plastics altogether?
Well, there's always...
And if we do, would that just take care of the problem completely?
Well, no, it wouldn't. And I think, and the part that gets starts to get, I don't know, make me sound like I'm sort of a school teacher, is that you have to be really precise and careful about the words and how you define mm-hmm. things. And that's why I'm really careful to say, well, everything is made out of chemicals. And what I'm talking about are synthetic chemicals. And I'm actually talking about certain synthetic chemicals. And plastics is just kind of like a big category of materials. And you can make a plastic out of all sorts of things. And you can make a plastic out of a petroleum product and some other elements in a way that you end up with something that's very useful but is maybe going to be really bad for the environment if you burn it, and may release certain molecules that will interfere with some really important hormones for health and metabolism and development. But you could also make a plastic out of some plant-based materials and some sugars in ways that would make something that was quite benign and potentially relatively easy to dispose of.
So what percentage of the plastics we use every day you would consider to be hazardous?
You know, I don't actually know that as a number, because there are just so many different materials out there. And I think one of the things that a lot of people, including policymakers and a lot of other really smart people who work in science and sort of product development in California are trying to work on now is, okay, we've now identified quite a large number of materials or chemicals that people are starting to call sort of generally chemicals of concern. Mm-hmm. We've identified some health and environmental impacts that we don't like, and we think we should not be using them. So then the challenge is, what do we use instead? And it's not always that easy to figure out, how do we go about figuring out what's safer, and how do we go about thinking about product design in a way that we'll end up with something that's really safer, and we won't take out one material we don't like and substitute something that has some other impacts, different ones that may also not be good.
Because these polymers have very, very complex structures in some ways, and you add other sort of molecules and polymers, I mean, building blocks to it, and it becomes something completely else. And let's step back and talk about some of the most common toxic synthetic chemicals we are exposed to. And one that you devoted one chapter to is bisphenol A.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists are finding that many commonly used substances like BPA, one thought to be safe, are actually very harmful. So talk about, and it has been quite controversial, actually, for the past few years. So talk about exactly what this material is, this compound is, and what does it do to the environment and to our body?
Well, bisphenol A was actually developed back, sort of going all the way back to the late 1920s, early 1930s, when it was originally developed as a synthetic estrogen, the hormone estrogen, to be a synthetic. But it was not, and people were looking at it as a possible pharmaceutical or pharmaceutical type applications, but it wasn't that strong a synthetic estrogen, so it was kind of put on the shelf. And several decades later, some synthetic chemists and chemical engineers ended up discovering that if you put together long chains of this bisphenol A molecule, you could make what we now have come to call polycarbonate plastic, something that is a really useful, lightweight, moldable plastic. You can color it. You can turn it into all sorts of shapes. It really is shatter resistant, and it just goes into countless, countless products. But what was discovered in the past 10, 15, 20 years now was that even though the finished plastic it makes is really, really strong, the bonds between those molecules aren't so strong, and that over time and with heat or with certain acids or other kind of liquids, those molecules will break down and those molecules of bisphenol A can get into the surrounding environment. And in the case of people, it could get into us if you're drinking from a bottle that's made with it, or somehow foods come into contact with it. And it turns out that very small amounts of that chemical can interact with and interfere with endocrine system hormones in ways that affect metabolism and reproduction and development and all sorts of other really vital body systems.
So why isn't it banned?
Sorry?
Why isn't it banned?
Well, it is not banned because there's quite a lot of back and forth about whether or not the levels at which people are exposed to this chemical, are those levels truly harmful? And one of the things that's really, really challenging about the science of what are called endocrine-disrupting chemicals, bisphenol A is just one, there are lots of them, is that they can be very active and have a very profound impact at low levels of exposure, but at high levels of exposure, they may not produce those effects. And the historical, traditional way we've gone about measuring the impacts of chemicals to assess their safety has been with the assumption that the more of something that an animal is exposed to, the more harmful it's going to be. The dose makes the poison.
Because in September of 2010, Canada became the first country to declare BPA a toxic substance. The European Union and Canada, BPA is banned in baby bottles, and China actually joined the ranks several months ago as well. But in U.S., it has been done voluntarily.
Yeah, and it's become very controversial, and quite a number of individual states have now passed laws restricting or banning BPA from baby bottles and toddler sippy cups and children's drinking products. It's used in a lot of other applications, and it's simply the politics and in this country that have made the way we regulate chemicals a lot more difficult than other places. And if you ask the industry that produces BPA, they will continue to say very confidently that the levels at which people are exposed are not harmful. So I think there's going to be a lot more back and forth on this before we're done.
And that's the voice of Elizabeth Grossman, the author of Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry. Elizabeth's writing has appeared in the Mother Jones, The Nation, Salon, and other publications. And if you want to join us, you may call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or call or drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to William in Belvedere. Good morning, William.
Thank you very much. As a physician, I became concerned about the criteria that are used to say when something is safe. I was particularly concerned when our local water district, the Marin Municipal Water District, wanted to start spraying pesticides in the watershed where it could get into the water. At any rate, I think it's important for the listeners to know that the testing that's done when they're trying to determine if something is safe is generally on rats and mice. And if they detect minor changes or, say, benign tumors rather than malignant tumors in the mice, then they'll say, well, it's just benign tumors. We don't have to pay attention to it. But what people should realize, and it's really kind of obvious, that mice and rats, the animals that are used for the testing, only live for 3 or 4 years anyway. And so they'll only be exposed in the testing for 3 or 4 years, because that's all they're going to live, because they're mice and rats. Whereas people are exposed throughout their lives. And therefore, one can be falsely reassured by hearing, for instance, that a pesticide like Roundup, that in testing it only caused benign tumors, not cancerous tumors. Is that understandable?
Yeah, I think you're making some really important points that I'm glad you reminded me to bring up, because I think one of the things that scientists who study environmental health effects of chemicals, and certainly people who are trying to formulate policy responding to the latest science, are grappling with is just what you bring up, is that none of us in no real-world situation is exposed to just one potentially harmful synthetic chemical at a time. And we're all now exposed, since before birth, throughout our lives, to a whole mixture of chemicals. But the way we assess the safety and the way we regulate chemicals is one at a time. And that's clearly woefully inadequate. And your comment also brings up another challenge, is that particularly with chemicals that interfere with hormone function, the effect that those chemicals create, the impacts they create, it's not often takes years to show up. And even if it's something acute like a cancer, it may take years and years to develop. And a great deal of our chemical regulation and safety standards around chemicals were developed to respond to acute, immediate effects. You breathe something, you get sick. It touches your skin, you get burned. And these long latency periods and these things that are slow to develop, and effects that are metabolic or chronic illness or affect successful birth outcomes, Our regulations and safety standards just don't respond to. So thank you for bringing all of those points up.
And that's Elizabeth Grossman, the author of Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Product, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry. And we are speaking about really what synthetic toxic chemicals do to our body, to our environment, and how we can come up with alternative ways of creating a sustainable and green chemistry for the future to come. I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.
You're listening to 91.7 KALW San Francisco, online, kalw.org. On our website, you'll find a connection to getting our weekly newsletter. You can sign up for it. It's absolutely free. Again, at kalw.org, just look for the link that says email newsletter. It's 10:30. Coming up at 11, World Have Your Say from the BBC. And at noon today, John Perry and Ken Taylor, and our weekly presentation of Philosophy Talk.
For those of you joining us now, I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we will look at the political events unfolding in Egypt and the U.S. foreign policy in that North African country in light of the uprisings in the Arab world and also the ongoing parliamentary election in Egypt. That is on Wednesday with Matt Martin. And on Thursday, we'll spend the hour with Ron Schmidt, author of Once Removed. It's a memoir about his life as a closeted gay man and his journeys through Catholic Church, marriage, family, single parenting, alcoholism, and working as a teacher in California public school. And Ron Schmidt is co-founder of South Bay chapter of the Bay Area Network of Gays and Lesbian Educators. And that's on Thursday with Rose Aguilar. And on Friday, it's our weekly media roundtable. And if you have any show ideas for us, you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or call us at 866-798-8255. But today we are speaking with investigative journalist and author Elizabeth Grossman about her latest book, Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry. And we really want to hear from you because I am sure you have also a lot of questions, concerns, and curiosity about what can happen for the future. How concerned are you about chemicals you're exposed to? In her book, Elizabeth says that what makes these chemicals' behavior of even greater concern is that they are finding their way into our food, our bodies, and the innermost working of living cells. So what can we do as citizens to bring more attention to this public health issue, find a systematic and a long-lasting solution to chemical pollutions? What do you want to know about pros and cons of green chemistry? We're going to spend a good chunk of the program speaking about really what we can do. And do you read ingredients on your bottles or other products you buy? After reading your book, Lizzie, I read some of the ingredients and I didn't like what I found because you warned me about them in your book. And then there is so much attention around phthalates and BPA. What does it really take for us to remove them from our homes, workplace? You can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. So, Lizzie, let's talk about another one of these chemicals before we go and speak about the alternatives, and that's phthalate.
Well, phthalates are a category of chemical, and they're used in lots and lots of different consumer products. Almost all of the things we're talking about are also used in industrial ways, but we'll talk about the consumer ones. And one of the most common ways phthalates have been used, and one of the ways they have entered our lives, is that they are used as what are called plasticizers in PVC, polyvinyl chloride plastic. So they are the phthalates, and there are lots of different molecules that all go by that general category name. A number of them are used to make PVC flexible and bendable. And if you didn't add that to the base material, you'd end up with something that was really brittle. So they're part of the mixture. And it turns out that, like a lot of these other chemicals that have turned out to be problematic, they don't stay put. They come out. They're what are called volatile. They can evaporate, as it were, out of the finished final product. And like BPA, they also interfere with hormones in ways that you really don't want chemicals interfering with hormones that regulate healthy reproductive and development and other health aspects like that. They're also used in artificial fragrances to make them last longer. They've also been used over the years in lotions and cosmetics and things like nail polish. They've sort of been taken out of a lot of those applications because of the health concerns, but they were really useful in making things flexible and bendable and giving them those kind of soft qualities.
And you say in your book that if one of the ingredients on the bottle says fragrance, for example, in shampoos, it's one of the configurations of phthalates?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, that's sort of part of the problem. We have the way we were in part of our chemical regulation system, and there's one big law in the U.S., which is the main one for regulating chemicals and commerce. It's called the Toxic Substance Control Act, and it's probably too long and boring to talk about in detail, but part of it allows companies to keep formula secrets, what's called proprietary or confidential business information, and the secret formula for what makes your perfume or fragrance is one of those things that companies like to sort of keep secret. And so if you see fragrance on a label, you know, it could be something that was completely harmless. It could be a drop of lemon juice or, you know, a crushed up rose leaf petal. It could be completely harmless, but it could also be a concoction of chemicals that included some things with adverse health effects. And the fact is, you just don't know.
And that's the voice of Elizabeth Grossman, author of Chasing Molecules. Now let's go to Susan in San Francisco. She has some questions about our regulatory systems. Good to have you, Susan.
Oh, thank you, and thanks for the good work you're doing, and I disagree. I don't think the Toxic Substance Control Act is boring.
Okay.
It's probably the most interesting thing in my life right now. I love it. I'm a nerd for Toxic Substance Control Act. It should be reformed. And I wanted to ask how you think the European Union and Canada and Norway as well, which is not part of the EU but has a very strong regulatory system, and how you think they can serve as models for us, because and strengthening our own EPA and FDA so that they're actually doing the job. Because I think there's you may be familiar with the writing of Sandra Steingraber,
yes.
the writer of Living Downstream, and I love her. She's a wonderful writer and is doing brilliant work in her own regard. However, her solution is that we should be our own regulatory agencies, and we should talk to our neighbors and our local city councils. And I respectfully disagree with her, as much as I love her. And I really think we need a strong regulatory system on the order of the EU or Canada, where, fortunately, thankfully, these products are not legal in European nation countries. They have been taken off the shelves, banned, and reformulated. And they're not allowed to hide behind proprietary information. So the person in Norway or in the EU country or Canada has better labeling information than we do. So what do you think about what we can do to strengthen our agencies so they do the job?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that listeners who aren't Tosca nerds, and I will admit to being one myself, might be helpful to know is that the Toxic Substance Control Act was actually written in 1976, which means it was written and set up before a lot of the science that we've just been talking about was even known. So one of the big problems is that it is just not written in a way that is adequate for keeping up with current science. So that's one thing that's kind of important to know about it. And it also deals with chemicals one at a time, which has quite a lot of drawbacks. And I think I would agree with Susan that as much as voluntary measures are really, really good, and ideally you want everybody to volunteer to do the right thing, and in some cases, for example, with polycarbonate for baby bottles, and for a lot of refillable kind of sports water bottles, general concern in the U.S. has caused the commercial market to shift to other products without some overt regulation in a lot of cases. But synthetic chemicals are just far too complex, and we depend on sort of manufactured materials for so many things that I think it's kind of impossible to do without a governmental regulatory system. And I think you also need those kind of guidelines to set sort of catch the bottom, you know, be a safety net for things. And it's also, as some people have said, if this isn't a problem we can solely shop our way out of. It involves sort of shifting education, and that's what the green chemists are also trying to do, to actually train people who make new materials to understand environmental and health impacts. Because if you get a PhD in chemistry, you're never required to take toxicology or ecology or any kind of environmental health science. And that kind of thing has to change. So I think it takes a lot more than just, you know, hoping you're going to pick the right thing.
And thank you for that call, Susan. And also we have a listener who wants to know about the differences in regulatory policies between states, for example, New York versus California.
Yeah, right now, a lot of individual states, in the absence of anything happening at the federal level, a lot of state legislators have heard from their constituents, whether it's over concern about chemicals that are getting into water or concern about certain chemicals in children's products. And so a lot of individual states over the past handful of years have started to pass laws for individual chemicals. And a number of states, California is one, Washington's another, there are a good handful of them, have started to try to put together more comprehensive chemicals management policies so that they can come up with frameworks that will begin to get us away from just looking at one chemical at a time. And so right now we do have a lot of different laws in a lot of different places, but one of the things that I think is kind of interesting is that when manufacturers look at that, typically they will tend to try to say, oh my gosh, we can't make 12 different, 50 different products. We're going to try to make sure we can sell our product in every state. So if California says no to something, Washington, Oregon, New York, Massachusetts, well, I think we probably are going to have to change how we make that product.
And we have an email from Mark in Oakland, and he says, I was speaking to a chemist friend of mine many years ago about these issues, whose answer was to require chemical producers to have the ability to break the chemicals back down before they release them into the market. We can build the chemicals, but should know how to break them down.
That is interesting. I'm not exactly sure what he means by break them back down, whether that means that we should be able to make sure synthetics are biodegradable, or before something goes on to the market, the formula is
I think
made
he means they're doing reverse engineering.
Yeah, that's
from polymers to go to the molecular level.
Right, to be able to find out exactly what's in the product before it goes to market.
Yeah.
To get more disclosure. And that's actually something that there is legislation that has been introduced to reform, to revise TSCA, and one of the key points is how to deal with more transparency, more disclosure of chemical compounds, of synthetic chemicals, while still respecting the need for businesses to be able to have something that they can patent.
And that's Elizabeth Grossman, the author of Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Product, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry. And if you want to hear from you, we'd love to hear from you. How concerned are you about chemicals you're exposed to? And in her book, Elizabeth says that these chemicals have really permeated every aspect of our lives, and we would love to hear from you about what alternatives have you found to these hazardous chemicals and materials. And to give us a call, you can dial 866-798-8255. You can also drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Again, 866-798-8255 or feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's switch to, we have about 10 minutes, so let's talk about alternatives. And you devote a bit more than a chapter in your book about green chemistry, but it's quite detailed. And you go back to green chemistry throughout your book. So what is exactly green chemistry, and how does it shift the mission of the modern chemistry?
Well, the most fundamental idea behind green chemistry is something that sounds incredibly simple, but is actually very complicated and kind of revolutionary, and that is that the best way of preventing hazardous chemical pollution and all of the adverse impacts that come with it is by not creating that pollution in the first place, by making sure that the new materials you make are truly safe for human health and the environment. And that is a huge challenge. And what green chemistry does, it is outline a set of principles which were designed by scientists, really for other scientists, to help them go through the steps of the questions you would ask to guide you towards making a safe molecule. Is this going to be something that breaks down naturally in the environment, or is it going to last a really long time? Is it something that's going to be soluble in fat and therefore could get into plant and animal tissues and build up in the food web? Is this something that if it gets into an animal's body or a person's body, is it something that is going to pass through the membranes of cells and interfere with hormones? And those kind of questions, which are completely outside of things that chemists traditionally have been asked to think about. So that's really at the heart of green chemistry, is asking those questions about the materials you're designing and doing this with the aim of getting the hazard out at the design stage rather than trying to deal with that hazardous pollution after it's come out of the smokestack or drain pipe or leached out of a finished product.
And so what can green chemistry do retroactively to help undo some of the damage already out there?
Well, I mean, that's a kind of interesting way to put the question. I mean, on the one hand, we need to invent a lot of new materials. Some folks who are working in green chemistry, such as the people at Terry Collins' lab at Carnegie Mellon University, are actually working on designing environmentally benign molecules that can be used as different kinds of cleaning agents to clean up hazardous pollution that's already in the environment, while there are other people, like the folks at John Warner's lab at a company called Warner Babcock, and there are lots of other people doing this kind of work around the country, Jim Hutchinson in Oregon, people at Rice University in Texas, who are working on making new materials that will be so useful that they can take the place of some of the things that we've been using for decades but have adverse impacts. And there's also a lot of education going on trying to train the next generation of chemists who are working on trying to find materials that can be used instead of compounds like bisphenol A or the perfluorinated compounds that we now use in semiconductor production or non-stick surfaces and things like that.
And that you have stopped using altogether.
I still have a lot of Gore-Tex in my life. I do live in Oregon, so
no, but Teflon, I mean.
Teflon, I decided I didn't want that in my life at all.
And if you want to join us, you can call us at 866-798-8255, or you can drop us a line. Question, comment at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Sophia in Oakland. Good morning, Sophia.
Good morning. I have a question about, I've noticed a lot of personal care products have their labels both in English and French, and I always assumed that meant that they were also being sold in Canada. So is it safe to assume that those are having more regulations and are going to have less of these harmful chemicals that you're talking about?
You know, I'm not sure I could make a blanket statement like that. Canada, and the reason you can't is because things vary so much from product to product, even within the same company. But there are certain chemicals that have been sort of taken off the market for things like personal care products in Europe and in Canada that we have not regulated in the same way. So if that product is going to be sold in Canada or something that's coming from Europe, there are, you know, you do have a good chance that there may be some labeling and some materials that are not going to be in them because they're made for a European or Canadian market. But I couldn't tell you absolutely because things just vary so much. Mm. And one of the reasons things vary a lot in the personal care realm I've discovered is that it depends a lot on the kind of packaging things are going into. And a lot of the chemicals that have caused some concern, a number of them are preservatives. And depending on what kind of container you put a product in, you may or may not need to load it up with preservatives. So things can vary hugely, even with it by the same manufacturer and for the same kind of item.
So you mean, for example, a bottle or one of these little boxes that maybe there is lipstick in or something else, even that determines?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you have a big open jar of lotion that's going to be exposed to air a lot every time you open it and as the jar empties out, it may need to have more preservatives put in it to keep it from spoiling than if you had something that was in a very tight little tube that had very little air exposure. And I've discovered that depending on the shape of the container, there may be different formulations. And in fact, that's sort of a green design approach to solving some of these chemical problems is look at the whole product design. And that's what some people have tried to do in getting around the use of the brominated flame retardants, which we haven't talked about very much, but are quite problematic, that go into plastics to make them fire retardant. And some a group in Michigan recently did a survey of car seats and you know, child car seats, and tested the foam and found that they were loaded up, a lot of them, with these flame retardants, which have some potential serious adverse health effects. And there's some manufacturers who have figured out, well, maybe we can figure out not how to find a different flame retardant, but let's redesign the car seat altogether, and they're using wool and cotton rather than plastic foam as the padding.
So let's go to another caller. We have about 3 minutes or so. Shan?
Oh, hello. I'm so glad to join you. As an elder who's experienced a lot of chemicals, here's my thought. How about the simple things that have existed for cleaning? For example, I'll get on a soapbox and talk about baking soda. What a great product. And there's vinegar, and there's seventh generation soap that doesn't have any odors. You can be attacked very easily by a box of Tide. It hits me right in the gut.
Thank you so much for that call, Shan. So that was my question in terms of the future of green chemistry. Are they going back to some basics as well, instead of looking at new material and how safe they can be, also using some things that are already in nature?
Absolutely. I mean that's one of the principles of green chemistry, is to figure out how to do things the way nature does. That's not exactly how it's worded, but that's the idea. How do you do things without put chemicals together that in ways that happen naturally, that you don't have to add a lot of extra things to make those reactions happen, whether it's energy or force or other chemicals? And it turns out sometimes the solution is to use a much simpler set of products or set of materials, instead of using this very long, complex set of ingredients, which end up on the back of a bottle in two-point type, which you don't understand and you can't read. There are sometimes solutions where you could use vinegar and baking soda or beeswax and olive oil instead of 14 different petroleum products. So a lot of this green chemistry education is around this problem solving of how to design a product that is going to achieve the function you want and the performance you want without being toxic. As John Warner says, a molecule does not have to be toxic to perform its function.
And I understand Professor Warner has started in 2001 a PhD program at the University of Massachusetts in green chemistry.
And they're now there are quite a number of colleges all around the country that are starting to incorporate green chemistry into their curriculum, which is pretty exciting.
So how promising is green chemistry's future?
Well, I think it's very promising, but it's not going to be easy because we have such a long history of existing products. And what is exciting, I think, and very promising is that there's this huge consumer demand. People really do want safer products. And there's also, I think, seems a large interest within people who are going into science of trying to figure out how you can make safer, more sustainable, better products. And for the first time, people who make new materials and people who study environmental sciences are starting to work together and collaborate so that we don't end up making some miracle new product, but that has all sorts of really hazardous other effects.
And we're running out of time, but I'm just curious, how much traction is this getting within the industry? For example, a company like DuPont?
Well, you know, almost every chemical company is looking at green chemistry in some way. Even the very big chemical companies, or especially the very big chemical companies, everybody is looking at trying to figure out how to be more resource efficient and how to make products that are not going to have environmental liabilities and waste issues. So it's actually, even behind the scenes, getting quite a lot of traction with chemical manufacturers.
And on that note, I want to thank you, Elizabeth, for sharing your time with us. Elizabeth Grothman, the author of Chasing Molecule. We should have you back and have a really intense conversation about this. This is going to take a long time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for spending your time with us, and thanks for listening. We'll put a link to web resources at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your calls and emails. Sorry we could not get to all of them. I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is what's coming up tomorrow. How should the U.S. engage with the governments emerging from the uprisings in the Arab world? On the next Your Call, we'll look at the emergence of Islamist parties in elections in Egypt and Tunisia. What do they stand for? Why are they so popular? And should the U.S. embrace them? Join the conversation with Middle East scholar Juan Cole on the next Your Call with Matt Martin and you.